Welcome to Base Camp for Men. I'm your host, Tony Rizak. This is a show that gives you insights and resources on how to live a more courageous life. We'll be looking at men, the current state of masculinity, and how to create a more inspiring narrative for all men. Welcome, and let's get started. Hello, Base Campers. Hope you're all doing well. Today is Season 5's last episode about Bitcoin. That might be a relief to some of you. It will be included next year as well. And you might ask yourself, why is he including this as part of the center of the Base Camp curriculum? Well, because it gives us maximum optionality, to use a concept that my guest today is fond of. Why do I love Bitcoin? It represents everything the state and the globalists hate: freedom, sovereignty, optionality, self-responsibility, we the people. They want us to continue to adopt systems with a centralized control structure. We the people counter with decentralized, sound, hard money and systems that will drastically alter our future and the possibilities that await us. Oh, it will take a while to cleanse our souls of the taint of fiat money, its corruption, debasement, its massive wealth inequality, to mention just a few. But the more you study Bitcoin, the more it reveals itself as a great ally to humanity, a quiet warrior who snuck behind enemy lines to detonate a fucking bomb into systems that sought to centralize everything, dehumanize us into a system meant to suffocate and suppress all human expression of individuality, joy, and personal freedom. Did you know that the U.S. dollar has lost 97% of its purchasing power since 1913? Wow. And it's lost 17% of its purchasing power in just the last 3 years alone. Something's got to give. Do you still think Bitcoin is a passing fad with no intrinsic value? Well, it's become the fastest asset to ever reach $1 trillion in market capitalization. To put it in perspective, it took Microsoft 44 years to reach this plateau, Apple 42 years, Amazon 24 years, and Google 21 years to reach $1 trillion in market cap. Bitcoin achieved this in just 12 years, and we haven't even got to institutional adoption yet that will just get accelerated with the spot ETF approval that looks to be heading our way in early 2024. Bitcoin looks like a loaded spring from where I'm sitting. Do yourself and your family a favor and get off zero, bro. Yes, I'm talking to you. Don't stand around flat-footed wondering what is what. At this point, I think you have all the information you need, right? Here are a few memes that relate to today's show. One is from Bitcoiner and visionary author Jeff Booth, who says, quote, "Imagine watching what happens to other nations and their people as their currencies lost value, yet failing to connect the dots to the consequences of it in your own country. Imagine," unquote. And one from author Tom Clancy, who says, quote, "What the government is good at is collecting taxes, taking away your freedoms, and killing people. It's not good at much else," unquote. Oh. And a longer one, but illuminating. I don't know where I got this one. I think it's probably from some libertarian site. But it says, quote, 125 years ago, you didn't have to ask permission from the government to collect rainwater, go fishing, own property, start a business, build a home, get married, hunt, own a weapon, cut hair, sell a product, protest, sell food. You can do virtually nothing without being extorted by the government and obtaining their permission first. If you still think you're free, you're deluding yourself. You are just a free-range human living on a tax farm," unquote. And Jack Dorsey, who simply says, quote, "Bitcoin changes absolutely everything," unquote. With these teeing up the episode, let's go have an interview with Mark Jeftovic. Enjoy. My guest today is Mark Jeftovic. Mark is an author and thought leader, a contrarian investor, and the CEO of EasyDNS. Here is my interview with Mark Jeftovic. All right. I am here with Mark Jeftovic, Bitcoiner, entrepreneur, thought leader, writer, Mark Jeftovic. Mark, welcome back to Base Camp for Men. It's great to have you back on the show.
Hey, Tony, thanks for having me. It's always great to be on here.
You know, you just got back from Europe. How was the trip? Were you able to like get a bead on any of the Bitcoin culture over there? Or were you just kind of going with the family? So it really wasn't a bit, but you know, I know you're a keen observer. Did you happen to have any conversations about Bitcoin while you were in Europe?
It's kind of hard to get me anywhere without me starting to talk about Bitcoin, but it was a family trip and we were just taking it as easy as possible. So there wasn't a lot of Bitcoin activity, but I will say they, you know, they've heard of it over there. I mean, obviously they've heard of it. Everybody's kind of aware of it. I was ordering a takeout meal in Dubrovnik, and, you know, I was talking to the guy on the phone and said, I said, you know, what payment methods do you take? And I said, and he said, we take it all. I said, well, how about Bitcoin? And he just started laughing. He said, no, we don't, but maybe we should. And I'm like, yeah, you should definitely. And then we were on a tour in Trogir, and the guide was telling us how Croatia had just moved on to the euro that year. I didn't know that. So Croatia just joined the euro this year in 2023, right before the inflation really accelerated. So that obviously dovetailed into, you know, this is why we Bitcoin. And, you know, she was pretty attentive to that. I didn't see any Bitcoin ATMs or anything like that. Serbia, I mean, you know, I met with a couple of my employees, and they're, of course, very hip to Bitcoin. They're like the only people I sort of met there. Then Berlin, you know, the other side of my family, and Berlin is kind of a hub. So no surprises there. But, you know, it's kind of, you have to remind yourself, like, the, you know, the so-called developed world, like the West and Europe, we're not among the top countries in Bitcoin adoption even now. Like the top three is like India, Vietnam, and Nigeria. United States only comes in at number four. Canada's not even in the top like 15. And the number one country for uptake is Ukraine. So it's kind of, when you think about it in that context, you realize it really is still quite early in the cycle.
Absolutely, it's early. Yeah, it's you know, we're at a weird spot where we're like, a lot of people are waiting for the ETF, the spot ETF. And I was listening to Michael Saylor talk about it, and he was saying, you know, because people are like, oh God, is this a terrible thing for Bitcoin? Because, you know, everything BlackRock gets into turns to shit. Like, they just try to, you know, they try to dominate every market. And so there's some of that sentiment of like, oh God, these guys are getting in. But he didn't have that. Saylor didn't have that perspective. He was like, it's a good thing. It's going to allow all of these large institutional investors like BlackRock and Vanguard and Fidelity to start to put more and more of their people in Bitcoin via the spot ETF. And he's like, he kind of took a meta, I appreciated, he had kind of a meta view that Bitcoin can't be stopped. You know, you can't, it's all going to, all that stuff's going to happen. There's going to be institutional adoption. There's going to be more countries that adopt, and there's going to be more large companies that put it on their balance sheet. And all of this is good for the asset. And I appreciated that, because I think I was probably one that was a little bit in the dread camp when I started seeing BlackRock's, you know, Larry Fink saying, hey, you know, this is an asset we really like right now. And I was like, oh no, here we go. I don't know. That's not really what I said I was going to lead off with, but I wanted to get your thoughts on that. Did you have a similar thing with the spot ETF, or, you know, how do you feel about that? Because we're kind of, it seems like they keep kicking it down the, down, you know, it's almost like this perfect storm where the halving, the Bitcoin halving, where there's this kind of supply shock happening in the spring. You know, they're saying April is when the halving is due of Bitcoin. And Gensler, the SEC chairman, keeps sort of saying not quite yet, not quite yet, is what it seems like he's saying. He's not saying there's no way in hell we're doing this. And most people that follow go, oh, they're going to do it. But he keeps pushing it. Now it looks to the first of the year, it could be spring, and it could really kind of line up with the halving, which would be something that would be like a boom, boom, I would think, to Bitcoin.
Right. Well, I think that, the spot ETF is inevitable. BlackRock moving into it is actually a huge victory for Bitcoin, because it plays right along with that old expression. Was it Gandhi? You know, ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they fight you, and then you win, right?
Yeah.
Especially Larry Fink's arc on how his personal opinion of Bitcoin, he hates this stuff. He called it an index for money laundering. And he was like, and then you saw him over the years kind of gradually moderate his tone. And the other thing about Fink in particular is he was very upfront about how he would use his market force to impose his behaviors and belief system on corporate America and corporate across the world. He was basically saying, you know, I'm embracing ESG and DEI as separate from actual concern about environmentalism, pollution, or ecology. I think they're two completely separate issues. But, and he was unabashedly saying, I'm going to use my market position to force my belief system on corporate boardrooms. And then what happened? Well, I always say BlackRock was the ones who had their behaviors forced.
Yep.
Because what I believe happened behind the scenes was that BlackRock, which does own most, like they own on behalf of their clients, the most shares and stocks and the most companies in the world. They're the largest asset manager. They're the largest shareholder of almost every company in the world. And they manage money for a lot of high net worth and ultra rich endowments, fiduciaries, that sort of thing. I believe those people turned around to BlackRock and said, we want exposure to Bitcoin. I believe 1% is going to be the mantra going forward. So I think these guys all turned around and said, we want exposure to Bitcoin, and if you're not going to give it to us, we're going to find someone else who will, or we are going to force behaviors and force some other entity into giving us that exposure.
Yeah.
So BlackRock had to do it, or they were going to lose. So they were the ones who had their behaviors forced at the end of the day. It really does open up the institutional floodgates. Like I know in the early 2020 cycle, they said, here come the institutions, you know, when Paul Tudor Jones announced and Stanley Druckenmiller announced. But that wasn't really the institutions. That was really the maverick billionaires. They're sort of the vanguard of the institutions.
Yep.
The institutions still didn't have that regulatory clarity. That's coming now, especially with the ETF, which will inevitably be approved. And there you have it. And so the other thing is, why is Gensler dragging his feet? Nobody likes to lose, right? Yeah. Gensler was flexing like he was the decider, like he was the decision-making entity, that, you know, crypto would live or die based on his say-so. And again, he's being confronted with the fact that this isn't really up to him. This is a tectonic global shift that is happening with or without him. And he, you know, he was originally pretty hip to crypto. He taught that course at MIT and I just think, I don't know, maybe he was a little too in close with, you know, Liz Warren and her anti-crypto army, and he just sort of got, you know, caught on the wrong side of it. And now there's nothing he can do about it. So he's just going to try and delay. And, you know, as the old Kissinger maxim was, declare victory, then withdraw.
Yeah. Are you going to make room in your portfolio to hold spot ETFs yourself?
Well, we've always said in the Bitcoin Capitalist portfolio, I think we say put 10% into, like 7% into Bitcoin ETFs and 3% into Ethereum. I know that's a dirty word in some circles, but just, you know, like Larry Fink, I've got readers who like are not Bitcoin maximalists. They're just like, I want exposure to this space, and I want the alpha that I'm going to get from Ethereum. Even though that's a whole different conversation, but it used to be 5 and 5 for the ETFs. And I've changed that mix to 7 and 3. And I may even change it again down the road. So yeah, there's a little bit of of an allocation to Bitcoin ETFs, spot ETFs. I mean, the futures have been out in the States for a couple of years. I've always said that even that was good for Bitcoin, but futures ETFs are for other people. You want other people buying futures ETFs. You and me and people listening, we want the actual Bitcoin. But the reason there's an ETF allocation in the portfolio is because, like you or you know, in the States, you've got these IRAs, you got these 401ks. Up here in Canada, we have these RRSPs. It's basically captive money until you retire, at least in terms of tax sheltering. So you might want to have some exposure in your retirement account, and you can't buy the actual Bitcoin in there. So we can get those stocks as a proxy, and you can get the ETFs.
It's an attractive addition to a portfolio. You can hold it in a Roth, for instance, and that can grow. And when you withdraw it, it's not taxable. So, I mean, the thought of holding being an early adopter, I mean, I'll probably buy the Bitcoin ETF as soon as it comes out. I'm kind of curious to see what he's going to do. Is he, I see there's a lot of deadlines all the same day. Is he going to, I wonder if, BlackRock being the big dog, if they'll be able to have it where they're kind of the first out of the gate, or if that's not what he's going to do, because that'll make it look like he's playing favorites and it's going to be, well, spot ETFs are going to be available on this day, and there's going to be, the 12 that have put in applications, Fidelity being one of them, ARK, and a handful of others. If it's just going to come, it's like, here's all the ETFs, which I imagine would be a feeding frenzy the first few days, because, all these giant fund managers are going to be looking to get positions before it inevitably goes up, especially at the beginning and getting close to the halving. So, we were talking about you're working on the Central Bank Digital Currency Survival Guide. I'm pumped. You gave me an early version and an outline, and so we're going to touch on some things there. What's funny, Mark, is I still have people, believe it or not, well, it's people, some people that are kind of in close to my family relations more than my friends, who, we have these kind of conversations a lot, my friends and I, but there's still people that have not even heard of a central bank digital currency. And for people like you and I, I'm like, how in the hell do you not, know what this is, what this means? Even my 16-year-old's like, you've never heard of a central bank. How can you not know what this is? I'm 16, I'm in high school, and I can tell you what they're planning to do with this. But I guess I just wanted to ask you kind of what is the driving force behind the central bank digital currency? Who's driving it? Why do so many people think that a cashless society is not a big deal? I think that's the other thing that I'm a little bit surprised on, is people are kind of like, we do everything digitally anyways. Like, they already know who we are. We have no privacy. Why not just go with the Fed now? Who cares? Like, it's no big deal. Like, they don't see any kind of, they don't see any kind of nefarious possibilities there. It's a really naive viewpoint. But I know quite a few people that are like, oh yeah, it does seem like they're going to digital only. There's a lot of places that don't take cash anymore, like the coffee shop and here and there, but it's no big deal. We're going that way anyways, but there's no intellectual follow-up of like, why is that happening? Who is it benefiting? And why might not that be great for us humans on the receiving end of it? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to unpack in there, and we'll start where we can. Mm-hmm. I think a cashless society is a foregone conclusion. Cash is doomed. It's just not a good thing. It's not a bad thing. That's just the way it is. Technology tends to, carve certain trajectories into the future. And again, we've talked enough times, you probably know, I don't believe in conspiracies as much as I ascribe things to incentives and dynamics. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those incentives are perverse, and sometimes those dynamics are completely idiotic, but you know, it sometimes even resembles a conspiracy to enslave all mankind or something. But because even in theory, let's say Bitcoin didn't exist, right? Even in theory, there is scientific research and academic research and even protocol specifications for doing digital cash in a completely privacy protecting way. Like, it's an option to do it. And I just think because the world is going digital, it's going to happen anyway. But there is Bitcoin. And so, you know, that's going to be a major option once cash is gone. I think the world is going to sort of bifurcate into, you know, people whose main economic activity happens on CBDC rails, and then people who have managed to protect and build wealth in, you know, what I call crypto land or digital asset land or Bitcoin land. The incentive now, I think, for CBDCs, more so than it's just technological progress, although it comes with some fringe benefits, is that it's a way to extend the lifespan of a deteriorating fiat currency.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everybody kind of knows. I mean, we've all seen the famous chart of the purchasing power of the US dollar since 1913. Yep. I mean, how much lower can it go? Especially with the debt that we're adding, the monetary expansion since COVID. You know, it can't go much further. We already got that taste of double-digit inflation, and nobody liked it. And so the Fed and the central banks are kind of trapped. There's too much debt. They can't lower interest rates. They can't raise interest rates. They can't stop printing money. They have to keep printing money. So that's a real mess. And so I think they're looking at CBDCs or digital dollars, digital euros. It's like, here's how we extend the runway another couple of decades to at least get us some time to think.
Yeah.
And then there's these ideologues piling on top of it. The Klaus Schwabs, the name escapes me. He's a Canadian, but he's that famous clip circulating on Twitter and YouTube of the guys talking at a Davos forum saying we're going to be able to have personal carbon footprint trackers. So I think those will inevitably be married to CBDCs. And again, there's not a bunch of people sitting around in a cigar-filled room deciding this. This is just the incentives.
Mm-hmm.
They're bad incentives, but that's what they are. And so Do you want to say anything now, or do you want me to just?
No, I totally agree with you. I think that, and I like that you present it as incentives. It gives you a different way of seeing it, because it's easy. A lot of people are just like, oh, the WEFs, you know, their sleeves are rolled up. They've been declaring this for a long time, that this is really where they want to go with things. And so it does dovetail with some of their documents and their planning, but I like that we don't have to go that way to still have it make a whole ton of sense just on incentives.
Can I jump in for a second?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Because that was, I think, that was a point I meant to make, and you just reminded me when you said planning. So the other important thing to know, like, I cover this all the time, every month, is how far away a retail CBDC still is. Because you see, a lot of people, the people who are aware of this are very alarmed by it, and I'm alarmed by it, and we're, you know, and it's troubling, the sort of incentives that are coming. But you see some of the really hyperbolic pronouncements, like, oh, there's going to be a bank holiday at Thanksgiving, and we're going to open up the next day. And FedNow, like, people think FedNow is like one step away from a retail CBDC.
Yeah.
It's not. Like, FedNow is just an interbank clearing layer. It's got its own issues, which we can talk about at a different time or later if you want. But the retail CBDC, the kind of thing that's going to be on your smartphone, that will eventually probably be tied into your carbon footprint, those are a long way off. I mean, even Lyle Brainard just said, like, this week, like, it's a long way off. We have no plans to do it. We don't know, like we needed direction from Congress. I don't think he said that, but a different Fed board member said that.
Mm-hmm.
In England, the Bank of England just started. I mean, they're not starting. They're calling for submissions and involvement in their CBDC research phase, which is starting in January, and it's scheduled to last 3 years. That's just the research and design phase.
Yeah.
So these things, like, there, I have to, you know, sort of tell people, we're years away from waking up one morning and your bank account balances have been converted into Fedcoin. I mean, mm-hmm. that can happen, but you have time now still. And if people think that, oh, they're doing it in the background, we don't know it, you can't build these kinds of rails in the background without people who are plugged into technology, plugged into the industry, plugged into payments and cloud mm-hmm. and network. All there would be footprints. We would of know course. It. There would be yeah. observers, and we would say, I mean, you know.
So what you're saying too is that in terms of living with a digital currency, making payments, you know, all this stuff, is that Bitcoin really is much further out the gate at this point, you know, for people. So, you know, I think there was a sense of some people thinking, I'm going to get caught at zero. And we can talk about this later about how to up level your Bitcoin game. But, you know, I'm going to get caught at zero Bitcoin. Like I'm kind of slow to move or whatever, and I'm going to be forced into central bank digital currency with the assets that I have, and it's all going to happen very fast. But you're saying no, they would, if things were happening that fast, all kinds of technologists, all kinds of coders, all kinds of people working in and around the ecosystem would already be talking about what's happening and timelines and all that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm saying we would already see it, and what we are seeing right now. So this is my other sort of stream of thought on this is, it remains to be seen if global retail CBDCs can actually be deployed before the global financial system implodes, right? Mm-hmm. So globalism is cracking at the seams. De-dollarization is happening. The U.S. world reserve currency will not last indefinitely. We talk about these things maybe in 5 or 10 year increments, but everyone knows, like, this is not going to last, and something is going to change. And it's possible that it could change, like, dramatically and in a volatile way, like, not smoothly.
That's
why I've been thinking there will be an impetus to deploy on top of a crypto that already exists. And my front runner for that has been Ethereum, who actually went to a Davos meeting like 3 years ago or four years ago and said, we'd be a perfect base layer for CBDCs. Brazil is building theirs on a private Ethereum fork.
XRP is in that conversation too.
And that's getting to that too. Yeah. So there's Ripple and there's Ethereum, who actually want to be the base layer for CBDCs. Yeah. And I do think that that's probably what's going to be an accelerator because they're not going to have time to build this from the ground up. Right. So that's something that we are paying attention to. But again, it's still a long way off. You know, when it does happen, it may happen very quickly, but that moment in time is not imminent. Like, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Dare say it's not going to happen in 24 or 25.
Yeah.
I can't see it happening, you know, I don't know, 5 years or so. Who knows?
Right. You know,
maybe sooner.
It's weird because you almost have to adjust your expectations. What you had said earlier about how the US dollar's lost, you know, it's 97% of its purchasing power since 1913. You can see that they just keep printing. They're stuck, like you said. They're stuck between, what got us in this mess is printing, but we don't have any other, it's the only thing we can do is print. We can raise interest rates, but that just kind of slows things down for a little while. And then we're back to where we are. And it's been kind of this boiling frog where people are like, wow, when did college education get to be 150 grand for, you know, it's like, well, it's not that the education is worth more. It's that your dollar is shit and it's being reflected in these astronomical prices. It's not, I think people are like, oh God, gas, you know, we've got war in, you know, Gaza, you know, gas jumped up to $6 a gallon. So, you know, there's a increase there that people can stomach, but when they really look at all the things that are high purchases, they notice, whoa, how did this get to be so expensive in just 15 years? And it's not the value of the other underlying thing that you're buying. It's that the dollar has been so debased that it's just not worth anything. And, you know, you wrote everything you've been told about Bitcoin is wrong. I wanted to give you a chance to unpack that a little bit. It's a catchy phrase, and I wanted to find out what have we been told about Bitcoin that is wrong?
Well, I mean, there's the standards, you know, it's backed by nothing, it damages the environment, it's roast. But in this particular context, that's a section in the Surviving CBDCs book where people who are hip to the risk of CBDCs and who are, you know, resisting it or cautioning against it, people who I think should know better are saying, are dismissing Bitcoin because they think it's in the same bucket as a CBDC. And I'm thinking, highest respect to her. I was a subscriber for years and years and years, but like a Catherine Austin Fitz, who I haven't really picked up on where she is on Bitcoin now, but you know, a few years ago it's to get us ready for a CBDC. And I tried to tell her and people who think that Bitcoin is the anti-CBDC, right? It's not, people sort of lump it in the same category. And that's the key point I want to hammer in the book is this is not early adoption of a CBDC. This is the anti-CBDC. This is the antidote to all this.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's the, you know, I tell people it's the people's coin. It's the people's digital currency. And I still have conversations where people, I can see them wrestling with the fact that there's only ever going to be 21 million, you know, and people that are smart, that are like, seriously, there's only, I go, yeah, no, absolute scarcity. It's funny, Mark, because it's like, it's a paradox because you think we've grown up in the fiat mindset so much that we take all of the inflation for granted. We take the unlawful taxing for granted. We just, everything we have come to accept. And it's funny because they can just print as much as they want. So the brain could go, there's plenty of fiat currency for everybody. You know, yes, it's kind of cantillion, like top down. They can print all they want. Don't you see? Yes, there's inflation, but it trickles down and we all benefit. That's my fiat mindset. But it's actually not true. They print and it's stealing from everybody, and it's making society worse than it was, not better. And then here you have this emergent asset, Bitcoin, with 21 million. And so in a fiat mindset, I've heard people say, well, there's not enough for everybody. And it's like, I go, I understand if you apply the fiat lens, you think 21 million, you know, I've got to get, if you don't have a whole Bitcoin, you're not going to get anywhere, but it's actually worth more. It's deflationary. And it's worth more over time. You don't need as much. Things will cost less and less money with the same amount of Satoshis. And it's such a mind fuck because I'm so, myself included, I'm so used to the fiat mindset that says things have to be, you know, things cost more and more and more. I got to make more and more and more money to afford the same shit every year. And Bitcoin says there's a different way. It's absolute scarcity. You hold your Satoshis and watch. Watch how much you're going to be able to buy with these things 5, 10, 15, 100 years in the future. And it's a wonderful, like, sort of mind game to play, or just like mind exercise. But there's a jump there because I think a lot of people in the fiat mindset think scarcity, I've got to get it. You know, there's this scarcity mindset where you're like, it's not that it's worth more and more. It's that, oh my God, there's only so many, I got to hurry up and get mine. But that's actually the fiat mindset creeping in, isn't it?
Yeah. It's, I mean, I've written in the past that, we're so brainwashed that we believe inflation is as natural as the seasons and soil erosion, right?
Yeah,
we just think like, oh, isn't that the way it is? But if you look at history of like for 250 years, the US, the British pound actually maintained its purchasing power and actually gained a little bit of purchasing power under the classical gold standard. Same thing with the US dollar, right? Like you look at the graph, that same graph of US dollar purchasing power that's down 97%. It's down since 1913 when they, you know, the Federal Reserve was created. Before that, it's a flat line for over 100 years.
Yep.
People don't wrap their heads around the fact that inflation and inflationary money is an aberration, not the norm. And people who should know better, like one of the best books I was reading this year was George Gilder's new one, Life After Capitalism. Love that guy. Love his books. Get all the way through to chapter 13, which is called Bitcoin Capitalism. And then he dismisses Bitcoin because of the hard cap, because it's deflationary. And I'm like, oh my God.
How does
like,
he miss it? Yeah.
Say it isn't so. George Gilder actually is like, it was like breaking my heart reading this. And people think that you can't run an economy. You can't run a growing economy on a deflationary currency. There is a book by a guy named Detlev Schlichter, who wrote Paper Money Collapse before Bitcoin or way back, maybe it's like 2012, 2013, who describes the process quite, you know, lucidly how in a deflationary currency world, in an expanding economy, it's just a matter of like your purchasing power increases and prices come down. And people are like, well, prices can't come down forever. I don't know. Do prices go up forever? Sure. Right. Seems like it.
Right. Have you got Jimmy Song's new book yet or no?
I have it. I haven't read it yet.
It's good. He's good. Good thinker. You know, I was talking with, I did an episode with John Haar from Swan, and we were talking about proof of work. And, you know, it had dawned on me recently, like when I first was researching, you know, I've been in Bitcoin, you know, learning about Bitcoin now for the past 3 or 4 years, and done a lot of, you know, podcast, listening to podcasts, reading all kinds of books, anything I can get my hands on. And, you know, proof of work is something that you hear about that the miners have. That's proof of work is what drives the, you know, validating the nodes and keeps the ledger working. And you know, I had that as a concept, but I realized from talking to people that there's a proof of work in understanding Bitcoin. It's like a quality of Bitcoin itself. And what I mean by that is that I've probably put in, I'll say, 100 hours of learning about Bitcoin. And it really wasn't until I probably got around 100 hours that I really started to feel like I had a sense of the landscape. It's complicated and interesting, but I don't think there's a lot where people will hear about it, but they don't want to jump in and start, they don't want to start investing just because you and I are talking about it. And they don't want to start investing because they've listened to a couple of podcasts necessarily. But there's something about proof of work. The more that you lean in and actually start to learn about Austrian economics, about what is money, all these different things that maybe you took for granted that you never rolled your sleeves up until now, there's like a proof of work quality to understanding what Bitcoin is, to the point where you said, look, I've got these assets and I'm going to allocate this amount because that's how comfortable I am in this new asset because I've done the work to learn about it. It's not that I'm better. It's just that in the early innings of the game, I found it fascinating enough to roll up my sleeves. But I think the more that people learn about it, the more comfortable they get talking about it, but also investing in it and betting that this is something that's going to be important in the future. I don't think you get that just from hearing, you know, a couple of things here and there. I noticed some of my friends and family are letting it pass because they're like, yeah, maybe. And I've started to talk about proof of work a little bit because I think it's a really important quality for people to bring themselves into understanding it because it is such an important thing. And you may not gain enough of an understanding without rolling up your sleeves.
Yeah. So the thing about proof of work is that at its root level, it provides this economic basis to what a Bitcoin is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because you have to trade energy to create a Bitcoin or to sign a block.
Yep.
So another George Gilder book from a few years ago, actually, The Scandal of Money, talks all about fiat currency from the point of view of like, this is what happens when money has no yardstick, right? And that's what fiat currency is. It's a zero yardstick money. You just spew it out. You can't have zero yardstick Bitcoin because you have to consume electricity to sign a block and to make new Bitcoin. And so every participant in the mining pool has to decide, am I going to spend my capital and my wealth on running these Bitcoin miners, or am I going to get them to do something else? Or am I going to spend it on a car or, you know, buy gold with it or something like that? So the fact that you have to expend energy and capital and wealth to generate these blocks makes Bitcoin like a hard-backed asset.
Mm-hmm.
Tony, there's like, we've got a construction bin in our driveway and the truck just pulled up to take it. Is that noise bleeding through here or?
Nope. I don't hear it. Yeah, I think we're good.
Okay. Sorry. If you have to just edit that bit out.
Yeah,
I just wanted to let you know. That's why I might've sounded a little bit distracted because they just pulled up now and started running pneumatics and stuff. So
no, we're good. Sounds good.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, and you wrote, I love what you write about sovereign individuals. You said sovereign individuals are the Davos kryptonite and that keeping sovereignty, keeping a positive mindset amongst the Orwellian Great Reset, doom and gloom. That might have been me, writing about what you had said about that more than your actual words, but we get what you're saying that. Seeing sovereignty right now, growing your sovereignty. I like that a lot because, you know, I'm in circles where there's a lot of, you know, people talking about devolution and white hats and stuff. And it's always this, or Trump's coming back, you know, and all of these things might happen. You know, I it's hard to say. I kind of have a foot in both worlds, but one of the things that creating sovereignty and Bitcoin is definitely a part of that is that you're not waiting for somebody to save you from the currency collapse. You're not waiting for the government to dole out X and universal basic income. Your sleeves are rolled up and you're taking responsibility, and the idea of less government intrusion is actually a good thing. And can you build your life around principles that reflect sovereignty and freedom rather than, oh, they're telling me I got to do this and I've got to do that. It's like, I wanted to give you a chance to talk about that. I know you write quite a bit about a sovereign mindset and what does that mean and how do we grow that?
Yeah, I think Robert Breedlove, I don't know if it was an original thing of his, but he said like all human rights come down to one thing and that's choice, right? And I had a lawyer, dear friend, longtime advisor, mentor, he passed away earlier this year, who used to say, you know, he who has the most options wins, mm-hmm. right? So we really want to cultivate optionality in our lives. And with, you know, I said the sovereign individual is the kryptonite of the Davos crew, because within the context of CBDCs, it comes down to, where does your economic sustenance derive from? Okay. And it's almost like when I thought about it, it's like a kind of inverse Maslow's hierarchy, right? So at the top of the it's an upside down pyramid or whichever. But at the most dependent level, you are completely dependent on the state for your economic sustenance. All right. How's the noise now? Because he's backing into my driveway.
And no, you're good. I think it's okay, good. Yeah, sorry. I don't know how, but it's good. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm trying to just focus now. But anyway, so at the top of that pyramid, you have absolute dependence on the state. Or let's say it's the bottom of the pyramid, right? Yeah. So yeah, you're getting UBI, you're getting stimmies, you're getting CERB up here in Canada, you're getting like stimulus payments because your business has been shut down because of lockdowns. When the CBDC comes out, you're going to use it because you have no other choice. Yep. So you're going to do whatever they say. If it's bound to your carbon footprint, you're going to like walk around. You're going to like reduce your red meat consumption. They're going to gamify it in your phone and mm-hmm. you're going to be playing that game. That's yep. your life.
Yep.
Below that, the next level, you've got a job. You're working for a company and you're basically doing what that company wants you to do because that's where your economic sustenance derives from. There's some good companies out there. There's some benevolent companies out there. But at the end of the day, the company basically exists to further itself as a standalone entity, right? Even my own company, they're the companies that I own. So if you're completely dependent on one job, then that's where your sustenance comes from. And if your company says, we're going to start paying you via the CBDC rails, then you're inside the system too.
Yep.
So let's say you get one level over from that. You're a business owner. You start your own business, but you've taken on VCs. Now you've got these external investors who are the majority of your cap table. Well, that's where your sustenance comes from now. Yeah. And if your VC funders just came back from Davos and said, this is what we're going to do, then that's what you're going to do. And so at the most, you know, the lower level, you've got maybe multiple income streams. You've got multiple businesses, you've got investments in different assets, mm-hmm. then you've got low customer concentrations where you're not just dependent on one huge client. Then you've got the most resilient base there. You're a sovereign individual. And the more people like that there are in the world, the more kryptonite there is for that entire sort of globalist WEF model.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And again, it reflects your principle of optionality, which I think is a great way to look at any of this, actually. And I'm sure we're going to see more businesses develop around taking Bitcoin payment. I just got to think that that's, you know, forward thinking. Bitcoiners, there's a lot of development, a lot of things being built right now. You know, you wrote in the guide about scaling up your Bitcoin game, getting off $0 cost averaging. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, I've kind of cherry picked some of your language,
yeah,
with my friends, you know, saying get off zero. That's a good start. You know what I mean? So, yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a Greg Foss sort of mantra. He's a Canadian. Yeah. Up here, I think probably everybody knows who he is in Bitcoin. He's like, just get off zero. You get off zero and you're going to be, you know, when this thing finally hits, I call it, you know, the great bifurcation, right? Where if, you know, you're caught inside the CBDC world with no other economic inputs, then that's your life. So getting off of zero at any amount suddenly puts you in a different category because I'm pretty convinced that Bitcoin is going to reprice accordingly. And we're not going to be thinking of Bitcoin in terms of hundreds of billions of dollars of market cap. We start to think about it in trillions and beyond.
Yeah.
So you get off zero. That's step number one. Step number two is your dollar cost averaging. And then as you level up your game, you are a business owner. Even if you have a full-time job, that's most of your economic base. But you've got some side hustles, you've got some side, you know, you've got some independent investments, you've got some income streams coming in on the side, you're becoming a business owner. If you can start getting some of those inputs coming in Bitcoin, like participating in affiliate programs that pay out in Bitcoin, or just as a business running a BTC pay server on a commodity VPS and you're taking Bitcoin payments and just getting those, and stacking them, right? Mm-hmm. Just not selling, not converting it to fiat and just stacking it. And then eventually you can start like even investing in Bitcoin. Like you know, there's the Bitcoin companies and you can start being a shareholder in those companies. I don't look at those stocks as a trade. I look at those as partial ownership in a business. Yeah. So you can start owning these Bitcoin companies, becoming partners in them. And that's how you're leveling up your Bitcoin game. And then maybe eventually you're going to start a Bitcoin venture, Bitcoin only venture or something.
I was smiling. Do you know who Ricardo Salinas is? He's one of the richest billionaires in Mexico. And
that guy. Yes. Carlos Slim. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a big Bitcoiner. And I was listening to his portfolio and he's so great. He was like, you know, I mean, he owns, you know, gads of real estate and stocks. He goes, I've just gradually moved over my liquid investments. And he's like, most of my liquid investments is in Bitcoin, like probably 60%. And he goes, I own Bitcoin directly. And he goes, you know, I own shares of MicroStrategy. I own a few Bitcoin mining companies and a few energy oil and gas companies and one or two like gold mining companies. And I was like, oh my God, this guy's got my portfolio. I don't have any gold mining, but I'm like, you know, he's got pretty much what I'm leaning on right now. And so I was like really happy because you hear a lot of the big dogs are like, you know, they'll say, oh, I'm in Bitcoin, but he really fleshed out where he's putting his money. And I was happy to see MicroStrategy and Bitcoin mining companies on there along with the asset itself. So, well, thanks, Mark, for coming on. Did you have anything that you wanted to tell our listeners about? What do you got going on? Where can they find you and your excellent newsletter? I love your newsletter, by the way. It's really great information. I feel like it comes out the right amount of time. Like it's not too much, it's not too little, and you do your research in a really great way. I just really appreciate it.
Whoops, sorry, I had the mute on. Thanks, Tony. I appreciate that.
You got it.
You know, so bombthrower.com is the free site where I put a lot of blog posts out and stuff like that. The newsletter itself is the bitcoincapitalist.com. You know what I'll do? I'll create, like, I'll give your listeners like a 50% off deal. So if they do say bombthrower.com/basecampformen, mm-hmm. I'll set up a link and they can get that at, you know, 50%, lock in that rate.
Beautiful.
And my main business is easydns.com, domains, web hosts, things like that. VPS servers, if you want to run a BTC pay server on it. I'll create a Basecamp for Men coupon code there too. And then the most recent thing, I just acquired dollarcollapse.com for my media portfolio. I don't know if you're familiar with that. That was it's more of a gold bug site. Mm-hmm. It's been around for like 20 years. John Rubino, I'm still in touch with him. Great guy. He exited about a year and a half ago. And so I just acquired that like a few weeks ago. And so I'm in the process of rebuilding that. There's a mailing list over there too. It's, like I said, it's gold and precious metals centric. Mm-hmm. I still am, you know, long gold and precious metals and have a portfolio of gold miners that goes back like 25 years. So,
right on. Yeah, that's great. All right, my man. Well, thank you for coming on Basecamp, Mark. So appreciate chatting with you. Always love the conversation and the insights. You take care.
Thanks, Tony. It's always a pleasure.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Mark Jeftovic. Mark has a couple of promos for you. The first is from his company, EasyDNS. For better domain registration and DNS hosting, go to EasyDNS and enter the code in all caps, BASECAMPFORMEN, for a 21% off discount. And to subscribe to Mark's excellent newsletter like I do and receive a 50% discount, simply go to either bombthrower.com/basecamp or thebitcoincapitalist.com/basecamp. That's it for this week. Thank you, Basecampers, and we'll see you around the fire next week.
If you find value in our show and wish to show us some love, we are now making that very easy to do. You simply go to www.basecampformen.com and click on Donate Support Basecamp. You'll find an easy way to make either monthly donations for as little as $5 a month, or you can donate just once. We love the monthly donation and hope to build this up over the coming months, but any show of support is greatly appreciated, honestly. Thank you for your support and for helping to keep Basecamp as a resource on your hero's journey. That's our show for today. Thank you for listening. Men, good luck in all your endeavors, and good luck on your hero's journey. This is Tony Rezac, and you're listening to Basecamp for Men.